Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the wonderful world of wildlife with Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. We'll talk with him about how you can start winterizing your garden and your home. We'll talk about the hunting season, the impact of Hurricane Ian on Florida wildlife, and take your questions as well. Do you hunt? If so, what are you seeing in the woods this year? What questions do you have about wildlife? You can join in. Give a call at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Scott Craven, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hey, Larry, it's great to be back. I'm coming to you today from the Kemp Natural Resources Station up in Minocqua. And it was a glorious drive up here this morning. The fall color was spectacular from about, maybe south of Wausau all the way up here. Really nice.
I tell you what, I'm looking forward to getting up in that part of the state myself soon. I want to go back to a past show, because there were a couple of questions that came up or comments that neither you nor I were able to answer. I know one of them had to do with a castrated buck not losing its antlers, if I'm not mistaken.
As I recall, the caller was calling to mention they had a captive buck in a park, and because he was castrated, he never shed his antlers. And he wanted some information on that. And as a matter of fact, that that has some truth to it. However, there are some caveats, as always. If the animal is castrated as a fawn, it will never grow antlers. If it's a castrated buck with mature antlers, when that is done, it will shed its antlers normally, but it grows a new set that will never lose their velvet. And then finally, if the castrated while it's in velvet, it will not shed, as the caller had mentioned, but they also don't lose the velvet. So you don't see those nice, hardened, polished antlers. So that's what I was able to turn up on that matter.
That's pretty interesting, actually. The other one was kind of cool was the title was Rat Snakes in Predicaments.
Yes, the caller was interested in rat snakes and, what where they were found, what problems they caused, and so forth. And anyway, I looked up that site on the internet, and sure enough, there it was, all kinds of weird and bizarre findings of snakes in places where people really didn't want any snakes. And I think the message for me was, it just goes to show you that you can find anything you want on the internet. So anyway, that takes care of those two holdovers from a previous show.
I'm glad we got those out of the way. Well, and by the way, I went on that rat snake site, and there was even one in there that had gotten caught in a hose. It's amazing the predicaments they get into. Let's talk about winterizing your garden and maybe your home against animals.
Well,
it's important.
Well, it is. I mean, there are two aspects, though, kind of both sides of the knife blade, so to speak. On the one hand, human nature is such that, hey, stuff's dead in the garden. It looks lousy. We need to clean it all up and rototill and have it all ready to go in the spring. And while that's true, there's a nice suggestion. The DNR has been coming up with lots of advice for homeowners and outdoors people over the last couple of weeks. And I have sort of a summary of that we can get to later. But the relevance right now is that one of the points was that it can be very beneficial to pollinators, to overwintering insects, and to a variety, to songbirds looking for food, to simply bite the bullet and say, man, I'm going to leave the garden a little messy this year, and leave those old asparagus stalks that have fruits on them. You know, leave that broccoli that went to seed, leave some of that stuff, and it provides some food and cover for a variety of wild animals and insects over the course of the winter. And then it's, you know, maybe even easier to pull out in the spring. I know that's kind of counter to what most people want to do, but it's something to think about, at least maybe in a back corner of the garden or someplace that you're not looking at out the kitchen window every minute. So that's just an individual decision people can make. The other side of the coin is cleaning up areas where potential pests can gain access to the house. And that means being careful with deep mulch around the foundation that could house voles, dense shrubbery, again, near the foundation that may house a rabbit or two that will cause damage to those plants themselves over the course of the winter. And then going over the house carefully to make sure there are no holes, gaps, cracks, or other access points that squirrels, starlings, other birds, other small mammals can get in and then cause problems in the home, in the attic, in the soffits, in the walls, in the basement, whatever. In my case, it's white-footed or deer mice. Most people know them as field mice. And it is a constant struggle. They only need a hole the size of a little larger than a dime to get in, and they're capable of making such a hole. And I end up with them in the furnace, in the air ducts, running around in the basement. They drive the dogs crazy when they hear them. And that doesn't sit well with my wife either. But nevertheless, it's a
problem. But I tell you what, Allison Madison had a question. She emailed one and relates right to this. She says she's seen ads for a device that emits high-pitched sound that is inaudible to humans, but it will repel mice.
Well, I'm always, yes, that's true. And those high-frequency sound generators have been around for many, many years. I haven't seen any lately, so I'm kind of surprised they're still garnering any attention, because I'm always suspicious of some of the gadgetry that's available to solve these problems. Ultrasonic sound or high frequency is very difficult. It has a very difficult time penetrating walls or anything that the mice might be behind or under or whatnot. So while they may have some application to move the animals out of open space and therefore closer to your traps or bait stations, where the effectiveness of those may be enhanced, I think the notion that there's a simple device that you can plug in, turn on, and your mouse problems are over with no further attention is a bit of a stretch in most cases.
Okay. Well, moving on then to other issues relating to this.
Well, the mouse situation I deal with primarily with, I'm kind of old school, mouse traps. Not anything new or fancy, but just a plain old wooden snap-type mouse trap. And if you get a few of those and essentially get into the mindset of running a trap line so you know where the traps are, that's the main thing. If you set and put out a dozen traps in the basement and don't pay careful attention to where you're putting them, you're always going to miss some, and then it's going to be, oh, what's that awful smell? And that's how you find the trap, because it's a decomposing mouse in it. So you need to be careful with the technique, but if you put the traps out, learn how to bait them properly and set them up against something. The mice tend to run along walls or, you know, other obstructions in the building rather than just carrying around in the wide open spaces of a room. So once you learn a little bit about how to become effective, you can really thin them out with those traps.
Scott Craven, our guest today, you can join in with your questions as well at 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Karen in Edgerton has a question for you, Scott. Hi, Karen.
I have a little green tree frog that's been hanging around the house, outside, of course. A cute little guy, and he comes and goes, and I'm wondering if there's any way I can provide some shelter for the winter for him.
There might be, but frankly, Karen, I don't think you need to worry about it. I've got lots of tree frogs like that around my house. They breed in my water feature, and every night they're lined up over the garage doors below the sodium light feeding. They won't be doing that anymore because it's getting too cold. But I did see one as I was cleaning up around some flower pots yesterday, and he simply hopped into the vegetation. They're perfectly capable of finding an overwinter site down in the mulch around your yard, or, you know, under a wood pile or wherever, and they'll be fine. You know, these small animals have a very high mortality rate, so that every one that might be in your yard is not necessarily going to make it till spring, but certainly enough will to perpetuate the population, and you'll continue to see tree frogs around the house. But you don't necessarily need to do anything special for them.
Here you go, Karen. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Ross in Middleton emailed. He's seeing dead skunks on the highways suddenly, wondering why now. Eddie also wonders about the main food of bobcats.
Dead skunk in the middle of the road. Isn't there a song to that
effect? I think there is.
Anyway, you know, this is a time of year when everything's getting out and getting active. These animals know that winter's coming. It's the fall harvest season. There's food everywhere. And everybody's out trying to put on a little weight and get ready for winter. So it's simply a matter of the raccoons, the skunks, the possums. I've seen lots of possums the last few days dead in the road, too. And they had all but disappeared earlier in the summer when it was hot and dry. So it's a matter of more activity on the part of wildlife. And when there's activity and they're crossing roads with the amount of traffic volume and the speed these days, some of them are going to get hit. And that's just a fact of life. But it doesn't necessarily signify a population explosion by skunks or careless driving or anything else, just that the skunks, along with a lot of other species, are more active right now. Let's see. What was
bobcats,
the other
part of that? What their main food is.
Well, they have a fairly diverse diet, but in most of their range, you know, they've been spreading lately down the southwestern part of the state, so that they're becoming more common in the driftless area. And I was going to say that in the main range in the northern part of the state, snowshoe hares are very important. Further south, probably cottontail rabbits, but they'll take a variety of things, from grouse and other ground-dwelling birds to just about any small mammal. They'll also feed on carrion, in other words, dead animals, things that have been hit by cars or were left behind. For example, a deer that's dressed out and there's a gut pile left in the woods, lots of animals will take advantage of that food source. So they have a pretty diverse prey base, but they are strictly carnivores.
Tom in Madison, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Tom.
Oh, hi, Larry and Scott. Thanks for taking my call. So I live in Madison on the east side near the Yahara River. I've been living in that area for about 30 years and have been doing a fair amount of fishing in the river over the summer. And I see muskrats and various other wildlife, but I spotted something scampering along the river this summer once, and then I saw them again now two or three or four times. And what I think they are, and Googling and looking at images, are mink. And I'm just wondering if that's likely. I guess I didn't realize they were such water lovers, so it makes sense. I saw one come right up out of the water about 5 feet away from me. And if their numbers are increasing, because I've never seen one prior to this summer, and now this summer I've spotted them, like I said, three or four times. And I'll just hang up and listen to your answer. Thanks.
Well, Tom, if you're fishing in the same general area, the mink's got a den there and probably a family, and you're just increasing your probability that you'll see them occasionally. But they're around. They've always been around. But they're reasonably small. They're, as a member of the weasel family, they're very quick and secretive. So the fact that they're there doesn't mean they're seen very often. I've seen them even, they're usually around water, but I had one encounter, a month or so ago. What was I doing? I was doing something in my strawberry patch, and I saw something brown go streaking across the garden, and then all of a sudden it stopped in the other end of the strawberry row and stood up on its hind legs and looked at me. I said, like, no, it's a mink, and zoom, he was gone just that fast. Never seen him before, never seen him since. Now, he was probably just passing through, but nevertheless, they're around. My neighbor reported seeing a female carrying her young across his driveway one at a time. So she had a den nearby. So there are, if you started to root around a little bit, I think you'd find lots of people that have probably seen them, but not commonly.
Scott Craven, our guest today, as we look at the world of wildlife for our state, and I think we're going to look at Florida as well a little bit. Clara Neipert, by the way, is our producer today. Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Talking with wildlife expert Scott Craven on the show today, I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. Lots of callers online. We've got some emails. Let's go to the phones and Cheryl in Bessemer, Michigan. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. Hey, I got the alternative for getting rid of mice. 3 years ago, I had an ermine move in the house.
Oh.
He came in a mouse hole. I didn't realize where it was coming from. And I had an old cat, and she just thought it was the coolest thing. But that ermine stayed for 5 months. I did not have a mouse in the house. It was very entertaining. They like cat food. And every now and then, I'd be sitting in the house reading, and the cat would be on my left-hand side, and a mouse would run across the floor, and that ermine would fly through the air and make his body huge, like some kind of flying squirrel, and get that mouse.
Well, Cheryl, that's a really cool story. For the listeners not familiar with what an ermine is, it's a short-tailed weasel. It's the one that they're brown with a kind of a beige belly in the summertime, and then they turn snow white in the winter with a black tip on their tail. And their claim to fame, ermine pelts used to be used to decorate Native American paraphernalia and so forth. And they're sometimes used in the fur industry, but it's a small, narrow diameter. They're kind of long and tubular, narrow diameter, a little bit bigger around than your thumb. But they move like grease lightning. They're incredibly effective predators. And the fact that you had one sharing your house for a few months is a really cool story, but probably not for everybody. they are ferocious little guys for their size, and it's not something you'd want a grandchild or something. So, what's this? And try and make a move on it. That would be unfortunate. But if the cat got along with it and it got rid of your mice, then hey, it worked out well in the end.
Thank you, Cheryl. I love that story. Appreciate it very much. Well, let's stay on mice for a minute. Kevin in Madison emailed. He's seen many of their snap traps emptied of the bait, peanut butter or cheese spread, and Kevin tries to jam the bait into the trigger, but they outsmart him and eat without setting off any trap. Any advice for him to outwit the smart mice?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I should have mentioned this up front when I was talking about keeping track of where your traps are and that kind of thing. There are a couple of things. First of all, Larry, let me apologize for clearing my throat and coughing a little bit. I'm still getting over the long aftermath of a long-gone case of COVID that the doctor tells me can persist as a cough and difficulty breathing for a couple of months. So I'm still dealing. But I've got a stack of cough drops here and a bottle of water. I'm trying. Anyway, this is a common problem with snap traps. They put either this bizarre-looking yellow plastic plate on there that looks like a piece of cheese. That's useless. I prefer the ones that do not have that just have the metal piece that you put the bail of the trap in to hold the little piece that holds the bail down so when the animal fools around with the trigger, it snaps. Now, if they're getting the bait off the trigger, it's because, it makes sense. It's just metal. There's nothing for the peanut butter, cheese spread, or anything else like that to adhere to. So I take all my traps when I'm getting started and cut little pieces of cloth. A scrap T-shirt or rag or whatever, maybe a half inch square or an inch square, and wrap that tightly in the trigger and then secure it with either a piece of fine florist wire or even a twist tie. And then with that in place, you can take the peanut butter or soft cheese or whatever and actually smear it in to that little bit of fabric so that it becomes tightly bonded to the trigger. And that'll get them every time. They'll start to get some of the bait off the outside, but when they go to tug on that last little bit that's embedded in the cloth, end of story. So if he's having trouble losing bait, that's the way to take care of it. And it's more of a problem in hot weather because the peanut butter or cheese spread or what have you gets softer, and the animals can just lick it off without setting off the trap. But with a little piece of cloth or a twist tie for the bait to adhere to, that'll solve that problem completely.
Take it from an expert, the man who knows, who's caught a lot of mice in his day, Scott Craven. Carrie in Richmond, let's go to you now. Hi, Carrie.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I am preparing my mobile home for winter, and so we won't be there for 6 months. So what's the best thing for me to set down for mice repellent? Now, I've done Irish Spring, I've done dryer sheets, I've done peppermint. What's your best suggestion so I don't get mice this season? And I can't do traps, obviously, because I won't be there.
There are a couple of possibilities. I mean, some of the things that you've talked about, naphthalene flakes or naphthalene, which are moth flakes, is a common repellent. So is ammonia. But these things are going to, you're going to come back in the spring and the whole place is going to smell of those repellents. I think the most pleasant thing that I've come across that I put every year in my boat and other things that I also put a pouch of these in all the drawers in my work cabinets in the garage. Otherwise, the mice will turn all my owner's manuals into shredded nesting material. And it's a product, I think it's called Fresh Cab. As a matter of fact, let me look here. I just happen to have an ad from a local hardware chain that everybody knows the name of. They advertise extensively, and it's a Wisconsin company. But they're advertising a product called Fresh Cab, and it's a rodent repellent. What it is a series of little pouches, and it contains very aromatic, there's some balsam fir, I think, and some other things that mice simply don't like. And it's billed as being great for cabins, RVs, basements, and garages, and lasts up to a month or two. I tend to use them all winter, and they seem to hold up okay. It's called Fresh Cab, and it's a botanical rodent repellent, and it comes in a pack of, I think, four. It comes in a box of four pouches. It's not inexpensive, but I've had pretty good luck with it, and it's something you can leave behind that won't make for a stinky mess in the house, and it seems to keep the mice at bay. How many of them you need to use in an entire mobile home, I think you need to read the label instructions to figure that out, but That's one possibility. The other thing is that if you're worried about using the traps as an insurance policy against, there's a decomposing mouse on the living room carpet, I think you could probably get by with cutting or getting some maybe 1 foot square pieces of plastic or even thin plywood and putting these down with the snap-type trap attached in the middle of it. And by attached, I mean just drill a small hole in the in one end and tack it right to the board or a piece of, like a plastic cutting board or something like that. And then what happens is the animal will be caught, as usual, but it can't go anywhere. It's not on anything that will be damaged as it decomposes. And there's not much mass to a mouse. So they tend to mummify rather quickly. Now that means you're going to come back in the spring and there's going to be some mummified mice scattered around the house, but they'll be on something you could just pick up and throw away and nothing will be damaged. And if it's been a month or two, you won't notice any serious smell either. So that's another possibility. And if the smell is an issue, you could hang some air fresheners or whatnot just to take care of that. So there's a couple possibilities for you.
There you go, Kerry. I can remember going to my parents' cabin in northern Wisconsin the first one of the year and climbed into bed, and something was kind of scratching and I on my body, and I took the covers away, and there was the skeleton of a mouse. There was nothing left of that mouse. I don't know, and I didn't see any stain or anything, so... It's amazing how those things work sometimes. Roy emailed. Well, go ahead, Scott.
Well, I was just saying, there's another thing people will see if they're trapping mice in a garage or sometimes even in the house, but usually in a garage or outbuilding. They may see a case where, hey, I got the mouse, but there's nothing left of it but a little bit of hide or perhaps the head that's actually caught in the bale of the trap. And there's, well, what happened to the mouse? And that's a case where you also have another common small mammal in there as well, and that's the short-tailed shrew, which is a dark chestnut brown with a short tail, and they're carnivorous, and they eat mice. So they're actually beneficial, much like Cheryl's ermine that she had in the house. The short-tailed shrews are actually beneficial, and they prey on the mice, but you can't help but occasionally catch them in the mouse traps as well. That's unfortunate bycatch. But if you're seeing the mice disappearing that you know you're catching, that means you've got some shrews around too. But don't worry about them. They're not a household pest like the mice are.
Okay. Mona and Reway, we go to you. Hi, Mona.
Hi. Thanks. My biggest concern about this whole thing is rodent poisons that people use, because the mouse may eat it in their house and then go outside looking for water and crawl into someone's neighbor's yard, and their pet will eat the mouse and die. And then also wildlife, birds of prey, all the way up to things like mountain lions have been killed by this stuff out in California. When are they going to outlaw this, like they're trying to do with lead?
Well, essentially they have in a different way. The common mouse poisons that you and I can go down to the hardware store and buy right now are for the most part anticoagulants. They kill the animal by causing it to bleed internally. There's very little or no risk of secondary poisoning with those things, especially not to something as large as a cat or a dog. So the problem you're describing does not exist with most common over-the-counter rodenticides. The ones that are a problem are all now classified, for the most part, as restricted-use products and can only be purchased and used by someone who's certified in their use, like a pest control operator. And presumably they're taking steps to prevent those problems you're describing. So a lot of the problem that you're describing that was common years ago has gone away, because the dangerous things, things like strychnine and 1080 or sodium fluoroacetate or some other rodenticides that are quite toxic, are no longer available to the average citizen. So I think, Mona, that problem has to a large degree taken care of itself. Now, that doesn't mean that there might not be someone who's misusing even products like Decon or Warfarin, which is an anticoagulant, and just dumping out a huge quantity of it. That could be a problem. But again, that's not necessarily a problem with the chemical itself, but rather with the person who is not using it correctly.
Mona, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Louis in Oconto. Hi, Louis.
Yes, I have two questions for Scott. And first, just a hi to Nick and John, hopefully on the Peshtigo River somewhere. Scott, my question with the mouse trapping, what do you do with when you have them in the walls? And it almost seems like they stay there, and I can't see any signs that they're in the basement anywhere, but I hear them in the walls. That's my first question. So,
well, there are two alternatives three alternatives, Louie. Number one, you can work from the outside in and just be diligent about inspecting the foundation, gaps around steps, anywhere utility cable enters the house, any possible entry point, and seal those up. Stuff them with steel wool, seal them up, cover them with hardware cloth, whatever, so that the animals have no access. Now, that's not an easy thing to do, especially in a large home. But if you can do it, then that problem is solved. If that's no good, the other approach that I have to use, because they do manage to get in, and they get into the heat ducts or the cold air returns. So where there's a return near the floor, I can usually unscrew that faceplate, take it off, and then put a trap in there, and sometimes get them that way. But if they're truly in the walls and you can't get at them in any conceivable way, then you really need to bring in a professional. And there are plenty of professional pest control companies that have tricks of the trade that they could use to get animals that you can't get at.
Yeah. Louis, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, I never thought we'd spend this much time on mice.
I had a lot of things I wanted to talk about.
Let's talk about something else for a minute, and it's sort of a sad thing. You were scheduled to do a tour again in Florida, and I'm sure that Hurricane Ian has eliminated that.
It has. We actually had two tours going this year. One was Yellowstone in winter. That's full and that's going. The Florida, which was billed as an old Florida tour, we had things set up this year to visit some sites that were kind of off the beaten track out on the barrier islands, like Pine Island and Cayo Costa. People have probably seen those places in the news. 2 days ago, I got together with Paul, the person who owns the travel company, and we just said, hey, this is, from what we've seen and what we've been able to find out from friends down there, these places that we were going to go are simply gone. The islands may still be there, but the vegetation is largely destroyed. Most of the infrastructure is destroyed. I'm sure everybody's seen the pictures of the Sanibel Causeway just washed away. Huge fishing piers like Naples and Fort Myers washed away. The destruction is staggering, and as you said, Larry, very sad. I've been going down there for years, and I have lots of friends down there, and there are places that, just places that you like to go. I'm afraid that's not going to be possible anymore, or at least not for a while. I'm sure they'll make tremendous headway in cleanup, but they've got a daunting task. Now, the other question, so anyway, that trip was canceled, as you said. But we're going to reschedule for winter of 24, and it will be this old Florida tour again. Hopefully things will be rebuilt and regrown, and hopefully I'll talk about this trip come next summer, and we can get folks down there again because we have a great tour, a great time on these trips. Now, what about what happened to the environment? There are some things that we had planned to look at that I'm worried about. I'm worried about their survival. For example, in Cape Coral, which is between Pine Island and Fort Myers and was probably largely underwater, there was an interesting and very large colony of burrowing owls. You know, cute little guys, a little bit smaller than a screech owl, but they live in a hole in the ground like a woodchuck and then come up above ground and sit there and look around. They're very popular with the tourists. But if these little birds took shelter in their burrows, I'm afraid they didn't. Well, if they somehow had the presence of mind to say, hey, we got to get out of here, and were able to fly into heavy cover or whatever, then maybe some of them survived. But I'm afraid that species like that that were particularly vulnerable probably took it pretty hard. One of the interesting things in terms of talking to one of the guides I use when I'm fishing down there, he was hunkered down in Estero when I talked with him and said it was really getting bad. I don't know what's going to happen. I haven't heard from him since. But he indicated that one of his concerns was that the tremendous influx of fresh water was in previous hurricanes one of the triggers he felt to red tide outbreaks in that area. And the red tide is very damaging to the fishery and the marine life all up and down the coast. So if one of the delayed reactions to Ian's destruction was to promote another episode of red tide, that would also be very bad, and that might have lasting impacts. So, you know, I'm sure birds, alligators, all manner of marine life, offshore fisheries, all took a hit from this hurricane. But how long? Right now, everybody's focused on the human loss in property and life and people's lives. So some of the discussion of the natural environment's going to have to wait for a while.
Yeah. Scott Craven, our guest today, wildlife specialist. He's an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. Questions for him, you can join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Looking at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time. If you have a question for Scott or maybe an experience to share, the number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Scott, before we go back to the phones, I know there were some announcements that the DNR has made on a few things, and I know you wanted to comment on them.
Yeah, they've come out with a lot of guidelines, I guess, to keep people safe and having a good time in the outdoors, and I thought some of them were worth repeating to the listeners. In no particular order, here are some that I've gleaned from their information over the last few weeks. For one thing, the archery deer season is open, and they rightfully so are cautioning people who are out hunting to take full advantage of the safety measures that are available. As you well know, Larry, that falls from tree stands, which are often used by bow hunters, is a tremendous source of injury and sometimes even death. So use a fall arrest system, use a haul line to get your equipment up in the stand. Basically, pay attention to all the basic safety recommendations when using a tree stand. The same goes for duck hunters. Wear a life vest in the boat. It's only common sense. Another one I hadn't heard about, that for people who are hunting in Canada, to be aware of the transport requirements on hunter-harvested game birds in place to avoid spreading avian influenza. It's still around. It must be still around, Larry. I paid $5 for a dozen eggs yesterday. What the heck's going on? Anyway, be aware that if you're trying to transport harvested birds across the U.S.-Canadian border, there are some restrictions in place to prevent the spread of influenza. There were some general precautions, too, for hunters in Wisconsin, especially for waterfowl, in the same vein of influenza spread. Don't eat or handle sick game. Use rubber gloves and wash up, common sanitation practices when cleaning birds, and cook all game to a minimum of 165 degrees internal temperature. They're also asking for more help in the fight against chronic wasting disease, asking people to get their deer tested, to properly dispose of carcasses, and to help hunters in your local area. Check out the DNR's Adopt a Kiosk or Adopt a Dumpster program, which you can find on the DNR website. And this will help people find a way to get their deer tested and also to dispose of carcasses that they don't know what else to do with. And also, I guess, last in the CWD arena is to follow all baiting and feeding bans, again, prevent the further spread. One more, and then we can move on to something else, is a general request to know your target. And this is particularly important for hunters during the deer season. Don't accidentally shoot a moose or an elk or any other protected species that might be mistaken for a game bird or animal. When hunting ducks and geese, watch out for swans and so on. It's only common sense, but the bottom line is mistakes in this case where a hunter shoots the wrong animal are completely unacceptable, period. If there's any doubt, don't shoot. So I think those are just some sound bits of advice for folks who are out and about this fall enjoying our tremendous hunting opportunities here in Wisconsin.
Let's take another call. Marlene in Wales, we'll go to you. Hi, Marlene. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have noticed there was some, I think they were hornets, maybe wasps, going in and out of a corner of my cedar siding where it butts up against the stone fireplace. So I assume there's a nest in there. And I had talked it over with someone, and we were going to spray it and decided, yeah, maybe not. Maybe this is something for a professional. I didn't get around to calling the professional yet, but there's nothing happening there now. What would be the best way to make sure that, you know, these guys are gone and not coming back?
Well, they may not be gone. They may just be in there. As it gets colder, these animals become inactive, and that doesn't mean the nest isn't still in there. If it were me, you could call somebody to do it. They come in and fumigate that corner of the building. But on the other hand, there are so many good wasp and hornet sprays in these spray cans that will shoot a stream, 15 or 20 feet if you're worried about getting close to them. But as it gets cold, and it's going to get, where were you, Marlene? In Wales?
Wales.
So it's supposed to be by Saturday morning, it's supposed to be in the 20s. Any wasps or hornets around would be completely inactive. At that point, if it were me, I would feel comfortable in, you know, going up on a stepladder to wherever that entrance is and really blast a whole can of wasp or hornet spray in there and then seal it up.
Yep.
And, I mean, that would be my approach, but I'm neither an entomologist nor a pest control expert. So if that makes you nervous or apprehensive in any way, then call somebody and they'll come take care of it.
Yeah, hornets are, they're going to be dead. Once winter comes anyway, I think you could seal up that spot and they wouldn't come back in there. At least that's what Phil Pelletieri, I think, mentioned the last time he was on the show. If they're hornets, they're going to be dead, all of them. And if you waited enough time, you could probably just seal it up and not have to worry about it too. So a few things. Go ahead, Scott.
Well, I was just saying the easiest thing to use, Marlene, is, I might still put a squirt in there of one of the sprays just to be on the, just to double down on it. But the other thing you can spray in there that will, if the hole isn't huge, is get a can of what's called Great Stuff. It's a spray polystyrene insulation, and you can fill up a pretty good gap with that stuff very easily and then let it harden, trim it off, and then, you know, finish it up so it looks decent from the outside and you're good to go.
Thanks, Marlene. Appreciate it. Bob and Franklin, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. We were walking around on our property in the Driftless area last weekend, and we found a rather large hole dug into the side of a little hump on a hill. I'd say it's probably 18 to 24 inches in diameter. Have any idea what would have made that den?
Well, three possibilities. A side hill where there's good visibility is a very much favored spot for a fox den, but also for coyotes. Coyote den be a little larger than a fox den. And if the den appeared, so for both of those animals, the den's going to appear, or the hole will appear primarily round. If it's somewhat flattened or oval, horizontally oval, then it could also be a badger. you know, a woodchuck might dig a pretty good size hole too, but not usually as big as what you described. So my guess would be one of the two members of the dog family.
Yeah, I think you're right, Scott. We had some fox on our farm home, and it was up on a hillside, just the way Bob described it. It was they were there for a long time. Thanks for calling.
I would just say also, Bob, if you're really curious about what's going on there, that's a perfect place to drive a stake into the ground and put up a camera, a trail camera, a game camera, whatever you want to call it, and see exactly who's coming and going. The other technique is to take a brush or a rake up and rake out the area around the hole and then see what kind of tracks appear. So a couple different ways to identify for sure who the homeowner is.
Let's go to Lyle in Oconomowoc. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I live in Oconomowoc with a large deer population at the site of our property. We have a lot of young trees, and I'm wondering if I wrap the trunk, how far up or down I need to cover the trunk so that the deer don't rub on them.
Well, I mean, deer can damage a variety of trees in a variety of ways, but this time of year, biggest problem for me is buck rubbing, as you suggest. And typically that rub is going to be no more than, on a average human, no more than waist high off the ground. I mean, they're not going to get up on, they may get up on their hind legs to browse on something and cause damage that way, like eating the twigs off an apple tree. But a buck won't do that to rub. They need the leverage to get those antlers essentially rubbed against the tree to do what they're trying to do to polish their antlers. So I'd say at most, probably 3 feet. But if you're starting to see rub activity, just take your tape measure along and get an average of how high those rubs are and then act accordingly in terms of mechanically protecting them.
Yep, good points. Good luck. Thank you. Al in Portage, on to you now. Hi, Al.
Hi, good morning or afternoon, gentlemen. I have a bat problem. I think I may have, they were in the attic of my home, older two-story farmhouse. I think I pretty much got it sealed up and they can't get in only because in the morning, early, very early mornings when they're about ready to roost, I've seen them getting behind my window shutters. Now, the shutters are just a fiberglass replica. They're not functional, but I see them going behind there. So when I harass them with a garden hose, they fly out, but also I got all kinds of stains running down. Well, I took the shutters down, and I was absolutely flown. Just unbelievable amount of waste that was in behind them. And I've also got a barn and a garage attached, and I've got them in there, too. Is there anything I can do to discourage them?
Well, Al, this is a complicated question, but you can get some pretty good, if you've got a sizable colony, a barn or outbuilding, that's a little different situation than the animals behind the shutters. And because bats have attracted so much attention the last couple of years because of the population problems they're having with white nose syndrome, which is a disease, the DNR has a very enthusiastic and competent bat team within the Natural Heritage Inventory Division. You can probably reach them online, and they provide some technical advice to how to bat-proof a building and when, because because again of the white nose syndrome, there are timing restrictions on when you can actually do this to be conservative of the bat population. So I think, particularly in the case of the outbuilding, you might seek some professional advice on when and how to do that. As far as the shutters are concerned, they are prodigious creators of guano, and that's what you were washing out there. But I've seen people have pretty good luck with shutters. So obviously it is a space. What kind of siding is on the building, Al?
Vinyl siding.
Yeah, so with the shutter up there, there are various gaps that the bats can easily get into. So if there's something, how many shutters are we talking about? Dozens or a handful or?
This was two of them off of one set of windows on the second level.
Okay, so envision sealing up the area or making the area behind the shutter impossible for the bats to utilize. And you can do that depending on how invasive you want to get. I think the easiest thing to do is get some 1-inch thick foam padding, like might be used for possibly for insulation or furniture stuffing or whatever, and cut that just slightly smaller than the shutter and put it up and then screw the shutter back in place over it so that the shutter compresses that foam against the wall.
Okay, good advice there, Scott. Scott Craven, our guest today on the show, he'll be with us till 12:30. We'll take a quick look at the news, and then we'll be back with Scott. You stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Scott Craven. He is an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist here to answer your wildlife questions or hear your wildlife stories, as a matter of fact. Have you been out hunting? Have you noticed any change in the amount of deer or ducks or bears this fall? Maybe another question, give a call, 800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Tim emailed us a question, Scott. In the mulch next to his arborvitae are small holes, and he's wondering what's digging these holes and should Tim do anything about them. And he doesn't say the size of the holes, unfortunately, but what might you guess?
Well, I think, Larry, there are probably too many possibilities to really pin it down. I mean, it could be squirrels, it could be chipmunks, it could be voles, it could be mice, could be a shrew. I guess it depends. If any animal is digging, however, there's a reason for it. So there's either something in there that's a potential food source or attractant, or in the case of the squirrels, they may be trying to bury something there. If there's no damage other than the holes, I guess I would advise him to not worry about it too much. Otherwise, just rake it out. And if it's a small enough area and you just don't want anything in there, you could cover it with a sheet of or a piece of a suitable size piece of hardware cloth, and nothing to dig through that.
We have Jan in La Crosse emailed, you mentioned shrews. She says she has shrews running outside the house and they're digging holes under her patio and digging runs in the yard. How does she get rid of them? I don't think she does.
Digging, you know, with these animal problems, Larry, it's always critical to success that you know exactly what the animal is. And in this case, digging runs in the lawn is not consistent with shrews. If it's, you know, the raised winding ridges in the grass that we see in the summer, then that's a mole. Completely different situation in terms of control. If it's little runways or sort of tunnels that you see in the spring when the snow melts, that's meadow mice or voles that are active under the snow. So there are a lot of animals that might do that kind of thing, and digging around the patio could be ground squirrels, chipmunks, and a host of other things. So I think that it would be beneficial to potentially set a small live trap or even a snap trap if they're so inclined to see what gets caught and get a better idea for who's the culprit. Because some of those animals are rodents, some of them are not. The control strategies are very different. And for most of them, we're facing the cold time of the year coming up. They're not going to be there at all. So yeah. She's running out of time to do anything about it no matter what. Say, Larry, I actually had a listener stop by and hand me an interesting news account from a 1921 Vilas County News that if we have a minute, it might be kind of interesting
sure.
to talk.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, this is the May 4th, 1921 edition of the Vilas County News. And it talks about the killing of cranes proves lucrative to saner hunters, about 1,000 killed.
Oh.
And the person who gave it to me said, well, what the heck's going on here? Could these really be cranes? And the article simply says that since the county and state have placed a bounty upon the destructive crane in this area, hundreds have been killed and the bounty of $1 each collected within the past few weeks. And it goes on to talk about how a couple of brothers from Saner had killed hundreds of the birds at a nesting place near a creek that's now, I think, called the Ontonagon River near Star Lake. Well, it goes on to say that the person who gave it to me said, well, are these really cranes? And the answer is no, they're not. This was a case where back in the 1920s, so, you know, a century ago, great blue herons were sometimes called blue cranes. And the herons were persecuted because they were fish eaters. And the article ends with that the crop of several of these cranes were cut open, and it was found that the birds had been feasting lavishly upon small trout from the nearby trout streams.
Huh.
It's been known that the crane is the most destructive of birds, living exclusively upon small game fish. So in those days, the birds, in this case great blue herons, were persecuted because they ate fish that people had an interest in. But it was not sandhill cranes or any other crane. It was what they called great blue herons. So anyway, but those days are long behind us. The birds are fully protected now. There are no more bounties. So that's a thing of the past, but kind of interesting to see what was going on 100 years ago.
Janice emailed. She's wondering how to find out about going on that winter Yellowstone trip you mentioned for 2023.
That trip to Yellowstone for this coming February is full, unfortunately. But I suspect we'll probably do another one in 24. At the same time, we reinstate the Florida tour, hopefully, in which case, you know, hopefully I'll be on next summer and have a chance to plug them and tell people how to get signed up. But if the caller really wants to find out what offerings are available, this is Door County Travel is the name of the organization. And I think she can probably find that on the internet and then maybe get on a mailing list or something as these trips get scheduled. And I urge her to do it because we have a pretty good time.
Door County Travel, that's the place. All right, let's go to Fred in Sauk City. Hi, Fred.
Hi, good morning. I have a question about a Cooper's hawk. This is a mystery that no one's been able to resolve for us. But last fall, our soil in Sauk is very sandy, and we have a deck at the back of the house. We're right near the Wisconsin River. And I went walking around and with my wife, and I happened to see these feathers sticking out of the ground, out of the sand. Almost under the deck. And I pulled on the feathers and an entire Cooper's hawk came out of the ground.
Yeah.
And it's like it just dove in and just buried itself. There was no digging around there. We unfortunately didn't take a photograph, but we looked at it and it seemed like it was in perfectly good shape. The neck was still pliable. So it seems like it had just died not long before. But it was completely buried other than, as I say, a few feathers of the rump sticking out of the sand. And it must have come in at almost straight down, because it had to actually get under a staircase that goes up to the deck. I just wondered if you have any idea how that could have happened, because, as I say, I assumed, of course, that somebody buried it there, but it was fresh, and it was just blasted into the ground, I think.
Hmm.
Well, I have a short answer for you, Fred. No, that's a mystery to me, too. The way you described the entry point, I can't imagine that the bird could have generated the force to bury itself in the sand. I mean, it's hard enough for a grouse or other birds that snow roost to bury themselves in soft snow. But sand, even loose sand, has a tremendous amount of resistance. So that I just don't think that's possible. So I think your other speculation that something buried it there is probably more likely the case. But what? We have no evidence to go on. No tracks, no sightings. I don't know. Cooper's hawk would not be an easy animal to capture by something that might be interested in eating it, and why it was cached or buried like that rather than consumed. That's just part of the mystery. There's no possibility of human intervention, is there?
I don't think so. I mean, we live in a neighborhood, but we're literally on the river. That's was the mystery, because I assumed that, and I said to my wife, I said, did you do this? Did you, like, put these feathers in the ground here by the flowers? And she said, no, what are you talking about? And I pulled on them, and out came this giant, you know, Cooper's hawk. It was stunning. And we looked again, and there was no tracks. There was no digging. It was perfectly smooth. It looked literally like it had just impacted into the ground. So that's,
yeah. So there you go.
I have no idea. We'll have to turn to our vast audience of experienced naturalists listening and see if they've ever heard of such a thing, but I have not. Sometimes like that, you know, Cooper's hawks are not particularly popular around homes because they are feeding on the birds that people are going to great lengths to attract. And, But this was your house where you found it, right?
Yeah, right at the deck. As I say, there's a deck, and then there's a staircase that goes up a full story. And it was, like, under that stairway. Like, just the angle, it's like, how could you possibly have gotten in there? It was a direct dive, and it's a mystery. Yeah, so.
Well, something got it into that position, but I don't know what.
There you go, Fred. Thanks for a mystery that remains unsolved for the moment.
Yep.
Rick and Portage, your turn. Thanks for calling, Rick.
Hi, guys. Thanks a lot. I'm wondering what the status or the prognostication is for the grouse population, let's just say north of Highway 64 this year. And secondly, why do I keep hearing a grouse drumming? I just heard it this morning when I was out in the woods with my dog. I mean, it's not exactly breeding season for grouse. And
no, it's not, but they will drum. Some will drum in the fall, too. So that's not too unusual. And it's such a cool sound. I kind of wish they'd drum all year. But but it is primarily a territorial thing in the spring, but some, especially young ones, will drum in the fall. As far as the predictions, the drumming counts were down slightly. The speculation is that we're in maybe the second year, maybe third of decline phase, down from the peak. So we're looking at probably another 2 or 3 years of declining populations before they turn the corner and rebuild to another population high, probably 7 or 8 years from now. So, in some areas where the habitat is marginal, grouse will be few and far between. In other spots where the habitat is really good, you know, hunters who are persistent are going to find a site where there's a brood or two and probably have some decent shooting opportunity. But overall, the population is down and declining.
All right. Rick, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dan and
hey, Larry.
Yeah, go ahead, Scott.
But did you want to talk about the recent wolf numbers that were released at all?
I'm glad you brought that up, because at 3:15 today on Central Time, Lee Rayburn's going to be talking about the state's wolf count and wolf situation with Adrian Travis from the UW Nelson Institute. So I didn't want to get that plug in for people who are interested. The numbers are down more than we expected.
Yeah, the DNR press release suggested that wolves were down about 20%, down from last year, and also further down from the year before in 2020. But the release stressed the fact that the population is not in any jeopardy, in the opinion of the DNR managers. And they also seem to avoid any particular links to last year's rather rushed hunting season. Now, there are some folks in the world of wolves who take disagreement on the population estimates themselves. And so I don't know what tone that discussion will take this afternoon, but at least people will have an opportunity to listen in.
Yep, that's at 3:15 on Central Time. Greg in Sheboygan, what's on your mind?
Well, I used to own a wolf, actually. I bought an Arctic wolf from Ellen Ottman. She lived 8 miles east of Rice Lake. And she would bury, if I gave her a turkey leg and I didn't take the bones out, she would just bury it. And if I gave her a deer that the sheriff's department, Julie Mead and that, they would see a dead deer on the side of the road and they'd come and give me a tag and tell me where it was. And if it was hitting the side and it busted the colon, and you know how they get that adrenaline rush, and it just flavored the meat, she would just bury it. And she buried it just like that, under the ground, totally, just like, so it might have been a coyote or something like that that just buried that animal.
Hmm. Yeah.
Well, something buried it, because I don't believe the bird could penetrate sand like that. It'd be completely submerged, so to speak. So we may never know. We probably will never know, but something buried it.
Yeah. Dan in Hudson has a northern Wisconsin cabin with cedar siding, and a woodpecker is drilling holes in the outdoor siding of the cabin. And any ideas to keep them from doing this? That comes up from time to time, doesn't it, Scott?
Yes, unfortunately it does, and it's as troublesome to deal with as bats and mice. What is Dan on the line? Can we figure out what kind of siding he has?
Cedar siding. He's not. He okay. Emailed us. It's cedar siding.
Okay. Well, if it's cedar siding that's manufactured siding to look like board, maybe it could be either one. It could be actual cedar boards. It could be T111 cedar faced siding. That's notorious for woodpecker damage. The holes will appear in a horizontal row of small holes as opposed to scattered larger holes in actual cedar. But that's a tough one, Larry, and requires probably more time than we actually have left in the program. So I would refer Dan to the Extension publication on woodpecker damage, which lays out all of the different causes and possible solutions. And that should be available online. You might be able to find a print copy at his local Extension office. And other than that, there are other national publications like the Internet Wildlife Damage Center operating out in Nebraska that will have a chapter on woodpecker damage too. But it can get pretty involved depending on the actual reason for the damage. So
yeah, for sure. Ray emailed wondering if moles are attracted to the larva of Japanese beetles in his yard. Attracting moles, is his yard attracting moles because they haven't used lawn chemicals?
Well, moles are insectivores, and they are after beetle grubs, whether it's Japanese beetles or something else, or worms, or other animal material, be it insect or invertebrate. So to the extent that the lawn is natural, so to speak, and harbors a variety of insect larvae or worms or grubs or whatever, then that's ideal habitat for moles. Equally as important to the moles, of course, is proper soil that will support their burrowing. So sand is no good, but good quality loam or black dirt, the moles will go to town. So I guess, is Ray just cured? Does he say he'd like to get rid of the moles, or he's thinking about the lawn chemicals, or...
I don't have that information. He just wondered if they are attracted to the larva of Japanese beetles. And
I don't know about Japanese beetles specifically, but I don't know why they wouldn't be. So, I mean, that's their food source.
Yeah, for sure. Keith had, back to mousetraps for a minute, Keith had a problem of bait disappearing, and he wiped clean, no evidence, and he was watching some traps closely, and he noticed ants swarming the bait shortly after the trap was set down. Found it didn't take much time for the ants to clean all the peanut butter and then disappear. He switched to jamming sunflower seeds securely in the bait holder, and the problem resolved.
Okay. Well, I think there are things certainly you can do with the ants, too, in terms of a perimeter of some of the ant toxicants or whatnot that would get rid of. Frankly, I'd rather have a mouse in the house than an ant infestation, but either problem can be solved.
And what is the deer season outlook? I know we're going to be talking about it down the road with Dan Small and his latest deer hunt 2022. But what's it look like from your perspective, Scott?
Well, there are plenty of deer out there. It's the whole thing is clouded still by the continuing spread of chronic wasting disease. So as we talked about earlier, there are things hunters should be aware of and steps they should probably take. But the general outlook looks very good. I know the bow hunters, at least the ones I know, are pretty excited about the next 4 days. It seems like in the bow hunting arena, there's a confluence coming up of a sharp drop in temperature, the right moon phase, the time of year, and a couple other things, and they're expecting just tremendous deer activity and movement from tomorrow through the weekend. So the youth hunt is this weekend. There'll be the kids out there with a mentor on Saturday and Sunday hunting, and it looks like it's going to be a great weekend for them. I'll be out with one grandson on Saturday, and looking forward to sitting there with him and see if we can get him a deer.
Well, Scott, on that note, I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. And you'll be back in, a couple months, and we'll do this all over again? How does that sound?
I'll be back in early December. We'll talk about how the deer hunt actually went and some Christmas gift ideas.
I like that. I like that idea. Okay, so thanks a lot, Scott. Appreciate it very much. Scott Craven, our guest today. Of course, Scott, an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. Always great to have him stop by and be with us. Well, let's take a look at what's coming up tomorrow on the show. On the Larry Mueller Show, we'll be getting some advice on staying safe on the internet just in time for Cyber Security Awareness Month. It's tomorrow on the Ideas Network, and we'll be having our regular guests from the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection joining us, and I'm sure we'll talk about some other consumer protection issues as well. But again, in the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.